Escuelas oficiales de idiomas. Pruebas de certificación. Comprensión de textos orales. Inglés. Certificado de nivel avanzado C1. Tarea 1. Dispone de 1 minuto y medio para leer los ejercicios correspondientes a esta tarea. A continuación de la lectura, escuchará una vez el texto o los textos orales correspondientes a la tarea 1. Tarea 1. Única audición. Texto 0.
Low density lipoprotein, or LDL cholesterol, is known as bad cholesterol for a good reason. It brings about fatty deposits that can clog arteries, causing carotid artery disease or coronary heart disease. The number one killer of Americans, PCSK9 inhibitors, formerly in our 2015 top 10, is the newest class of cholesterol-lowering drugs. These new drugs are lowering cholesterol to unprecedented levels. And when PCSK9 is taken along with a statin, LDL levels are being reduced by 75%.
Texto 1.
Alarm fatigue is a top technology hazard in hospitals nationwide. The steady stream of sounds can desensitize staff to a critical situation. Studies indicate that nearly 44% of inpatient cardiac arrests were not detected appropriately. In search of a solution, groundbreaking technologies have been emerging. Technicians providing a constant eye off-site use sensors and high-definition cameras to monitor pressure, heart and respiratory rates, pulse oximetry, and more.
Texto 2.
An alert is automatically generated that triggers on-site intervention. A recent study analyzing a newly developed central monitoring unit reported a 93% survival rate of cardiopulmonary arrests. Along with sophisticated algorithms and new systems, these results are capturing the attention of hospitals around the world, increasing the potential to save lives.
Texto 3.
A substantial growth in hospital readmissions has resulted in a Medicare payout of $528 million in 2016. And there is an opioid epidemic involving 2 million Americans. Now, physicians are ready to overhaul strategy. Research has indicated that an enhanced recovery after surgery that permits patients to eat before surgery, limits opioids by prescribing alternate medications, and encourages regular walking is reducing blood clots, nausea, infection, and muscle atrophy.
Texto 4.
One program with a group of 9,000 surgical patients has reported a drop in surgical complications by 1/3. The program has also reduced its opioid prescriptions by 21%. And one center has shown that patients going home within 2 or 3 days of surgery has an extremely low readmission rate of 2%. In 2017, collaborations were formed between surgical societies and large healthcare systems to to drive funding and education for hospitals looking to implement ERAS protocols.
Texto 5.
The CDC estimates that vaccinations will prevent more than 21 million hospitalizations and 732,000 deaths among children born in the last 20 years. With that realization and the recent outbreaks of Ebola and Zika, researchers are making changes. New ways of developing, shipping, storing, and vaccinating are being connected to stave off current and future diseases and epidemics. Companies are finding faster ways to develop influenza vaccines.
Texto 6.
Thinking outside the syringe, alternate methods like edible vaccines, mucosally delivered vaccines, intranasal vaccines, and vaccine chips are also under development. And in 2018, an adhesive bandage-sized patch for the flu vaccine is expected to be marketed to kids and adults alike. These new platforms are in a position to keep individuals and entire nations healthier than ever.
Texto 7.
Extending the healthcare environment to the patient's home has been a goal for decades. After years of trials, experiments, and modest growth, distance health technologies are about to become a widely accepted standard of care. Why now? Experts point to the preponderance of connectivity. 80% of Americans now own smartphones, and nearly 75% have broadband service. Innovators from many disciplines have been removing demographic, logistical, financial, regulatory, and technological barriers.
Texto 8.
Today, more than 90% of healthcare delivery systems have or are building a telehealth program. Distance health technologies are also extending far beyond the common two-way video platforms. Over 19 million patients are projected to use remote monitoring devices that feed regular information to their doctors in 2018. Platforms are also being built that enable more interaction between patients and clinicians around the world. Experts believe that the emergence and acceleration of distance health technologies and services are assured in 2018.
Texto 9.
More than 21 million Americans suffer from obstructed sleep apnea and are not seeking treatment. For many, continuous positive airway pressure, or CPAP devices, provide the relief needed. But for a subset of patients, it brings to mind anything but rest. These masks often represent noise, bulk, and irritation. 40% of patients refuse to wear them, prompting innovators to search for a less intrusive way to treat obstructive sleep apnea. The result? Neuromodulation.
Texto 10.
Controlled by a remote or wearable patch, these systems include a breathing sensor and a stimulation lead powered by a small battery. The implant, inserted during a minimally invasive surgical procedure, uses stimulation to the tongue and throat to keep the airway muscles open throughout the night. This technology is slated to take the sleep market by storm in 2018, bringing a better night's sleep to more patients.
Tarea 2. Dispone de un minuto y medio para leer los ejercicios correspondientes a esta tarea. A continuación de la lectura, escuchará dos veces el texto o los textos orales correspondientes a la tarea 2, con un intervalo de 20 segundos. Tarea 2. Primera audición.
Some of the official predictions made about climate change sound biblical in scale. More drought, more famine, more flooding, more of the most powerful tropical cyclones, and of course, the seas rising. A familiar litany. And one they say we need to do more to fight. Something that will need rapid, far-reaching and unprecedented changes in all aspects of society. Our current no-action path is like this, rising carbon emissions. And that would take us to a more than 4-degree rise by 2100. But there is policy in place that should restrain carbon growth onto this path. That probably means about a 3-degree rise. And if countries make good on some of their promises, it should be a touch lower than that. Scientists, though, have been hoping for this path, which would mean about a 2-degree rise. Now, though, they say we should aim for under 1.5 degrees. Now, that half a degree change may not sound like much, but scientists think it could radically reduce the harm done to our world by climate change. The thing is, though, to get there, we have to reduce our net carbon emissions to zero by the year 2050. And that means huge changes to the way that we live, to how we get around, to how we generate electricity, to how we arrange our cities, to what we wear, even to what we eat. You can see why zero emissions is so radical if you look at carbon emissions in historical context. Hitting zero by 2050 would need a very sudden shift in direction.
It's about making the Chinese leadership, the Indian leadership, many of the African leaders decide to move away from coal. And unfortunately, that's quite expensive for these countries. And the real issue is whether and who is prepared to pay the substantive costs of a fast switch out of this most pernicious form of fossil fuels.
Now, individual countries make their own climate plans. Getting them to follow through, though, is hard. For one thing, getting to 1.5 degrees would mean investing 2.5% of the world economy every year from now until 2035 into energy infrastructure. According to Bloomberg, that's a sevenfold increase. 2.5% of our economy would be about £50 billion, more than we spend on defence.
We cannot hold to the current standard of living and really radically decarbonise. This has cost to us. We are, to be blunt, living beyond our means, and no politician wants to tell us that.
The fact of climate change is no longer in dispute. How we respond to it, however, is a political challenge that will only become more acute in the coming decades. And the price tag is rising.
Chris Cook reporting. So, is it possible to get the planet to align around the latest science? In a moment, we'll talk to Simon Beard, who studies existential risk at Cambridge University, and to Baroness Worthington, who's drafted the UK's Climate Change Act 10 years ago. But are the chances of a global response weakened when the leader of the world's second largest polluter is sceptical? Well, as I say, joining us here in the studio, Baroness Bryony Worthington and Simon Beard. Simon Beard, do you think human beings are capable of dealing with a problem like this?
Yes, we are. And the good news is climate change is anthropogenic. Human activity is causing it. And that means we have the capability to stop it. You know, this isn't sunspots. This isn't some global conspiracy. This is something that we're doing and we can undo. We have a bright future ahead of us, and we have the capability to bring that about. And it would be an incredibly good deal to do that.
So you'd
do
much
that
rather
now.
We were causing it than it was something else, because that means we have agency in this and we can do something about it.
When you study human extinction, the thing you really look for is an extinction that people are causing and that they know what they're doing. Right? The things that we worry about are the things that, like with technological development, where there's a risk but we don't really understand it, or where something might happen and you have no control over it, space weather, asteroids and so on. Those are much scarier. Climate change is just a question of what do you think is going to be the best investment for the future? And, you know, it's becoming increasingly apparent that actually climate mitigation is going to achieve a great deal for us and our children.
OK. Baroness Worthington, I mean, the politicians are struggling to find £3 billion, £4 billion for social care, let alone £50 billion to spend into energy so we can have the same energy we have now, except cleaner.
But cleaner is quite important because there are co-benefits to us doing this. So cleaner air in cities is going to reduce the National Health Service bill because we'll have fewer people suffering from all the related health impacts of the diesel fumes that are currently choking our cities. So there are lots of cost savings.
How many years is it now in a row that we've frozen petrol tax rather than put it up fuel duty?
Well, there's a big controversy about the fuel duty price, but actually, if you look at other policies that we've seen in the power sector, just putting a price on alone isn't actually the important thing. The important thing is to recycle funds and to provide deployment support for new technologies. So the new wave of electric vehicles that are coming, they've been really pushed forward by policy, and policy in China, most interestingly. So, you know, Europe's got a way to catch up on transport, but I'm sure we will do so.
Tarea 2. Segunda audición.
Some of the official predictions made about climate change sound biblical in scale. More drought. More famine. More flooding. More of the most powerful tropical cyclones. And of course, the seas rising. A familiar litany. And one they say we need to do more to fight. Something that will need rapid, far-reaching and unprecedented changes in all aspects of society. Our current no-action path is like this, rising carbon emissions. And that would take us to a more than 4-degree rise by 2100. But there is policy in place that should restrain carbon growth onto this path. That probably means about a 3-degree rise. And if countries make good on some of their promises, it should be a touch lower than that. Scientists, though, have been hoping for this path, which would mean about a 2-degree rise. Now, though, they say we should aim for under 1.5 degrees.
Now, that 0.5 degree change may not sound like much, but scientists think it could radically reduce the harm done to our world by climate change. The thing is, though, to get there, we have to reduce our net carbon emissions to zero by the year 2050. And that means huge changes to the way that we live, to how we get around, to how we generate electricity, to how we arrange our cities, to what we wear, even to what we eat.
You can see why zero emissions is so radical if you look at carbon emissions in historical context. Hitting zero by 2050 would need a very sudden shift in direction.
It's about making the Chinese leadership, the Indian leadership, many of the African leaders decide to move away from coal. And unfortunately, that's quite expensive for these countries. And the real issue is whether and who is prepared to pay the substantive costs of a fast switch out of this most pernicious form of fossil fuels.
Now, individual countries make their own climate plans. Getting them to follow through, though, is hard. For one thing, getting to 1.5 degrees would mean investing 2.5% of the world economy every year from now until 2035 into energy infrastructure. According to Bloomberg, that's a sevenfold increase. 2.5% of our economy would be about £50 billion, more than we spend on defence.
We cannot hold to the current standard of living and really radically decarbonise. This has cost to us, we are, to be blunt, living beyond our means, and no politician wants to tell us that.
The fact of climate change is no longer in dispute. How we respond to it, however, is a political challenge that will only become more acute in the coming decades. And the price tag is rising.
Chris Cook reporting. So, is it possible to get the planet to align around the latest science? In a moment, we'll talk to Simon Beard, who studies existential risk at Cambridge University, and to Baroness Worthington, who's drafted the UK's Climate Change Act 10 years ago. But are the chances of a global response weakened when the leader of the world's second largest polluter is sceptical? Well, as I say, joining us here in the studio, Baroness Bryony Worthington and Simon Beard. Simon Beard, do you think human beings are capable of dealing with a problem like this?
Yes, we are. And the good news is climate change is anthropogenic. Human activity is causing it. And that means we have the capability to stop it. You know, this isn't sunspots, this isn't some global conspiracy. This is something that we're doing and we can undo. Yeah, okay, we have a bright future ahead of us, and we have the capability to bring that about. And it would be an incredibly good deal to do that.
So you'd
much
rather we were causing it than it was something else, because that means we have agency in this and we can do something about it.
When you study human extinction, the thing you really look for is an extinction that people are causing and that they know what they're doing. Right? The things that we worry about are the things that, like with technological development, where there's a risk but we don't really understand it, or where something might happen and you have no control over it, space weather, asteroids and so on. Those are much scarier. Climate change is just a question of what do you think is going to be the best investment for the future? And, you know, it's becoming increasingly apparent that actually climate mitigation is going to achieve a great deal for us and our children.
Okay. Baroness Worthington, I mean, the politicians are struggling to find $3 billion, $4 billion for social care, let alone $50 billion to spend into energy so we can have the same energy we have now, except cleaner.
Cleaner is quite important because there are co-benefits to us doing this. So cleaner air in cities is going to reduce the National Health Service bill because we'll have fewer people suffering from all the related health impacts of the diesel fumes that are currently choking our cities. So there are lots of cost savings.
How many years is it now in a row that we've frozen petrol tax rather than put it up fuel duty?
There's a big controversy about the fuel duty price, but actually if you look at other policies that we've seen in the power sector, just putting a price on a loan isn't actually the important thing. The important thing is to recycle funds and to provide deployment support for new technologies. So the new wave of electric vehicles that are coming, they've been really pushed forward by policy, and policy in China, most interestingly. Yeah. So, you know, Europe's got a way to catch up on transport, but I'm sure we will do so.
Tarea 3. Dispone de un minuto y medio para leer los ejercicios correspondientes a esta tarea. A continuación de la lectura, escuchará dos veces el texto o los textos orales correspondientes a la tarea 3, con un intervalo de 20 segundos. Tarea 3. Primera audición.
Hi, I'm going to talk to you today about laughter. And I just want to start by thinking about the first time I can ever remember noticing laughter. This is when I was a little girl, I would have been about 6. And I came across my parents doing something unusual, where they were laughing. They were laughing very, very hard. They were lying on the floor laughing. They were screaming with laughter. I did not know what they were laughing at, but I wanted in. I wanted to be part of that. And I kind of sat around at the edge going, hoo-hoo! Now, incidentally, what they were laughing at was a song which people used to sing, which was based around signs in toilets on trains telling you what you could and could not do in toilets on trains. And the thing you have to remember about the English is, of course, we do have an immensely sophisticated sense of humour. At the time, I didn't understand anything of that. I just cared about the laughter. And actually, As a neuroscientist, I've come to care about it again. And it is a really weird thing to do. Now, to understand laughter, you have to look at a part of the body that psychologists and neuroscientists don't normally spend very much time looking at, which is the ribcage. And it doesn't seem terribly exciting, but actually, you're all using your ribcage all the time. What you're all doing at the moment with your ribcage, and don't stop doing it, is breathing. So you use the intercostal muscles, the muscles between your ribs, to bring air in and out of your lungs just by expanding and contracting your ribcage. And if I was to put a strap around the outside of your chest, called a breath belt, and just look at that movement, you see a sort of rather gentle sinusoidal movement. So that's breathing. You're all doing it. Don't stop. As soon as you start talking, you start using your breathing completely differently. So what I'm doing now, you see something much more like this. In talking, you use a very fine movement of the rib cage to squeeze the air out. And in fact, we're the only animals that can do this. It's why we can talk at all. Now, both talking and breathing has a mortal enemy. And that enemy is laughter. Because what happens when you laugh is those same muscles start to contract very regularly, and you get these very marked sort of zigzagging, and that's just squeezing the air out of you. It literally is that basic a way of making a sound. You could be stamping on somebody. It's having the same effect. You're just squeezing air out. And each of those contractions, gives you a sound. And now the contractions run together. You can get these spasms, and that's when you start getting these kind of things happening. And I'm brilliant at this. In terms of the science of laughter, there isn't very much, but it does turn out that pretty much everything we think we know about laughter is wrong. So it's not at all unusual, for example, to hear people say, humans are the only animals that laugh. Nietzsche thought, oh, humans are the only animals that laugh. In fact, you find laughter throughout the mammals. It's been well described and well observed in primates, but you also see it in rats. And wherever you find it, humans, primates, rats, you find it associated with things like tickling. And that's the same for humans. You find it associated with play, and all mammals play. And wherever you find it, it's associated with interactions. So Robert Provine, who's done a lot of work on this, has pointed out that you are 30 times more likely to laugh if you are with somebody else than if you're on your own. And where you find most laughter is in social interactions like conversation. So if you ask human beings, when do you laugh? They'll talk about comedy and they'll talk about humor and they'll talk about jokes. If you look at when they laugh, they're laughing with their friends. And when we laugh with people, we're hardly ever actually laughing at jokes. You are laughing to show people that you understand them, that you agree with them, that you're part of the same group as them. You're laughing to show that you like them. You might even love them. You're doing all that at the same time as talking to them. And in fact, the laughter is doing a lot of that emotional work for you. Something that Robert Provine has pointed out, as you can see here, and in fact, the reason why we were laughing when we heard those funny laughs at the start, and why I was laughing when I found my parents laughing, is that it's an enormously behaviourally contagious effect. You can catch laughter from somebody else. And you are more likely to catch laughter off somebody else if you know them. So it's still modulated by this social context. You have to put humour to one side and think about the social meaning of laughter, because that's where it really, that's where its origins lie.
Tarea 3. Segunda audición.
Hi, I'm going to talk to you today about laughter. And I just want to start by thinking about the first time I can ever remember noticing laughter. This is when I was a little girl, I would have been about 6. And I came across my parents doing something unusual, where they were laughing. They were laughing very, very hard. They were lying on the floor laughing. They were screaming with laughter. I did not know what they were laughing at, but I wanted in. I wanted to be part of that. And I kind of sat around at the edge going, hoo-hoo! Now, incidentally, what they were laughing at was a song which people used to sing, which was based around signs in toilets on trains telling you what you could and could not do in toilets on trains. And the thing you have to remember about the English is, of course, we do have an immensely sophisticated sense of humour. At the time, I didn't understand anything of that. I just cared about the laughter. And actually, as a neuroscientist, I've come to care about it again. And it is a really weird thing to do. Now, to understand laughter, you have to look at a part of the body that psychologists and neuroscientists don't normally spend very much time looking at, which is the ribcage. And it doesn't seem terribly exciting, but actually, you're all using your ribcage all the time. What you're all doing at the moment with your ribcage, and don't stop doing it, is breathing. So you use the intercostal muscles, the muscles between your ribs, to bring air in and out of your lungs just by expanding and contracting your ribcage. And if I was to put a strap around the outside of your chest, called a breath belt, and just look at that movement, you see a sort of rather gentle sinusoidal movement. So that's breathing. You're all doing it. Don't stop. As soon as you start talking, you start using your breathing completely differently. So what I'm doing now, you see something much more like this. In talking, you use a very fine movement of the rib cage to squeeze the air out. And in fact, we're the only animals that can do this. It's why we can talk at all. Now, both talking and breathing has a mortal enemy. And that enemy is laughter. Because what happens when you laugh is those same muscles start to contract very regularly, and you get these very marked sort of zigzagging, and that's just squeezing the air out of you. It literally is that basic a way of making a sound. You could be stamping on somebody. It's having the same effect. You're just squeezing air out. And each of those contractions, gives you a sound. And now the contractions run together. You can get these spasms, and that's when you start getting these kind of things happening. And I'm brilliant at this. In terms of the science of laughter, there isn't very much, but it does turn out that pretty much everything we think we know about laughter is wrong. So it's not at all unusual, for example, to hear people say, humans are the only animals that laugh. Nietzsche thought, oh, humans are the only animals that laugh. In fact, you find laughter throughout the mammals. It's been well described and well observed in primates, but you also see it in rats. And wherever you find it, humans, primates, rats, you find it associated with things like tickling. And that's the same for humans. You find it associated with play, and all mammals play. And wherever you find it, it's associated with interactions. So Robert Provine, who's done a lot of work on this, has pointed out that you are 30 times more likely to laugh if you are with somebody else than if you're on your own. And where you find most laughter is in social interactions, like conversation. So if you ask human beings, when do you laugh? They'll talk about comedy, and they'll talk about humor, and they'll talk about jokes. If you look at when they laugh, they're laughing with their friends. And when we laugh with people, we're hardly ever actually laughing at jokes. You are laughing to show people that you understand them, that you agree with them, that you're part of the same group as them. You're laughing to show that you like them. You might even love them. You're doing all that at the same time as talking to them. And in fact, the laughter is doing a lot of that emotional work for you. Something that Robert Provine has pointed out, as you can see here, and in fact, the reason why we were laughing when we heard those funny laughs at the start, and why I was laughing when I found my parents laughing, is that it's an enormously behaviourally contagious effect. You can catch laughter from somebody else. And you are more likely to catch laughter off somebody else if you know them. So it's still modulated by this social context. You have to put humour to one side and think about the social meaning of laughter, because that's where it really, that's where its origins lie.
La prueba de comprensión de textos orales ha finalizado. Deje su cuadernillo de examen cerrado sobre la mesa, compruebe que ha consignado en su portada los datos requeridos y siga las instrucciones del examinador.